Yeah, good morning, Dr. Iran. I'm very pleased to meet you. Could you just, for listeners to this tape, state who you are, what your job title is, and a bit of biographical background? Mm-hmm.
So my name is Pierre Rollin. I'm originally French, trained as a physician in France, and I'm working in the viral special pathogen branch here for the last 23 years on hemorrhagic fever, including Ebola, but other hemorrhagic fever too. I work in the lab. I did in the different outbreak a little bit of everything, so I can work on what is needed for an outbreak when you have one in any condition.
Could you just give me a sense of your deployment and experience in previous Ebola outbreaks, previous to 2014?
So I start in for Ebola in 89, but that was Ebola Reston in Virginia here. That was purely lab work with non-human primate. Mm-hmm. And then in 95, went to Kikwit, mm-hmm. Doing at that time clinical management of patient. At mm-hmm. that time, MSF was not involved yet in treatment of Ebola patient or hemorrhagic fever patient. Mm-hmm. They provide us the resource, the supply, but mm-hmm. With Philippe Callan, that was in the branch at that time, mm-hmm. we took care of patient in the world. Mm-hmm. Follow-up outbreak in Gulu, for example. In 2000, I ran the lab for 2 months. And was working in the lab, a little bit of clinical, but mostly lab work. Mm-hmm. In other outbreak, I've done some ecological studies, such as capture of rodent, capture of bats. I also work in communication training of healthcare worker mm-hmm. and communication with the general population.
Okay. So prior to the 2014 outbreak, where would you have ranked Ebola on a list of infectious disease threats, global infectious disease threats?
It's a very rare disease. It's still a very rare disease. It's mostly in Central Africa with Congo, Gabon, Republic of Congo, Uganda, and South Sudan, that the main place where we found Ebola before, and we will find it later. Nothing in West Africa, except that single case of Ebola Ivory Coast that happened in 94. But all the time we were there, it was always a short-term outbreak when people start to respond, international teams start to respond. It was few months only, maybe at before the response, there could be several months of an unknown disease found in some place, but no specimen collected and no exact diagnostic made. But it was always a short, in all the other area, the population don't move very much. So even if you had evacuation of patients from the epidemic area to other city, it was very limited. We had, for example, in Uganda, in several outbreaks on patients that went up to the capital in Kampala, but that was 1-2 patients, no transmission at that time, and very rare. So it's this outbreak, 2014 and 15, have been special because of the duration of the outbreak and obviously the number of cases.
Right. Before we get to that, where were you when you first heard that there might be Ebola in Guinea Forestier? Were you surprised, and do you think it could have been anticipated ahead of time?
I was here in the office. We got a phone call from people in the laboratory in France, and also phone call from some people we know at MSF, saying that it seems to have an Ebola outbreak, and apparently it was confirmed. So it was just the day, a few hours before it was officially confirmed, the 21st of March, by the Ministry mm-hmm. of Health of Guinea. I think I was surprised, obviously, because I didn't expect an outbreak there. But there was some old paper, and I like old paper, published in French in 82, showing antibody to Ebola in some patient in Guinea. So it was, and we also know that the bat reservoir, if we all agree on that bat reservoir, could have exist in that place of Africa. So the range, distribution range of these bats are include Central Africa and along the coast of West Africa. So it was a surprise, but when you think about it, yeah, it could have happened there. One thing with Ebola is you never know exactly when it's going to show up. You rarely go back to the same place, and it's linked to, obviously, the bad behavior and the human behavior, and the non-human primate in Central Africa. Yeah.
So can you just take me through kind of what happened next from your perspective? I'm interested in the chronology of your visit to Guinea, what your objective is, and what your assessment is of how the response is going and the degree of the risk or the degree of the threat that's being presented by Ebola.
So at the beginning of the outbreak, when we learn about it, obviously I'm always interested in responding to outbreaks, so we decided at that time that we will respond. In addition, it was in a French-speaking area, so I like it. The branch had some work in Guinea before for Lassa fever, and I was in Guinea in 94, 96, for a short period of time, but I knew a little bit the location. We also had a new software that was developed to manage outbreak, to manage the case and the contact that was developed. So we developed it after the four outbreak that we saw in 2012 in Uganda and Democratic Republic of Congo. So we say that's a good place to try to see if it works. Unfortunately, it was in English, and so we... by the time we arrive in Guinea, we translate the program, we translate the question, but it was still a work in progress, so we took with us also an informatician that was involved and a programmer was involved in that program, and we changed version every night, more or less, for the first months, because it was improving and correcting the mistake. But when we arrived there, it was obviously an outbreak that I was in. So we arrived the 31st, the first team.
Of March.
Diagnostic, again, confirmed 21st, and we arrived 31st. We cannot go in a country just like that. We need to be invited. We need to have visa and all the system. So we arrived, and it was already an outbreak that was in two different areas, in the Guinea Forestier, but also some case in Conakry already. With a transmission in one hospital in Conakry, in a Kipe hospital. So it was already in two places. So some of the team went to Guinea Forestier. I went just to check what's going on. And then
Did it alarm you that it was already in Conakry, which is a major city?
Yes and no, because he arrived before in major city like Kampala or Kinshasa, and he never went... transform in a big outbreak, but we still have, even at this day, Guinea and Conakry behave differently than Freetown on Monrovia. We never saw in Conakry what we saw in Monrovia with that huge transmission. Conakry was a place where you had case, a transmission, but normal way of transmission like we used to see in previous outbreak. And multiple reintroduction in Conakry. And we don't have explanation for that, but it's never been like it was, again, in Monrovia. So it's always a problem when it's the capital. It's always add another layer of political, administrative problem because that's the capital. Obviously, it has a huge impact on the economy of the city already with the number of visitors coming from oversea limited, not really tourists, there is not a lot of tourists, but businessmen and people involved in the mining, mostly that cancel trip and stop. The hotel was more or less empty beside our team.
So there How big was your team?
We were five or six. two AP Craig. The informatician and myself, so I think five. So there was the capital, and there was mostly the Guinea Forestier, where there seems to be more people. But when we arrived, obviously WHO response team, some of them were already there, MSF were there, so it was not that. How to say that? It was an outbreak like any of the other outbreak that we saw before, starting or having started already for a few weeks, but didn't seem like anything that would have happened or would happen in the future. So in that place, so it was not a big deal.
So just to summarize, yeah. I think this is important. So you're saying at that stage, having had experience of other outbreaks and seen these deployments before, it would be fair to say that this is business as usual?
Yes, it looks like, tastes like, smell like a regular outbreak seen in previous area. So in the equation of that maybe I didn't put or nobody else put, was the fact that Guinea people are traveling a lot, and also within the country, or eventually outside of the country, but within the country, that the place where in Guinea Forestier where that outbreak happened, it's not the most developed part of Guinea. People are just considered quite often a lower class of Guinean. Mm-hmm. They're in the forestier, so when they say it's a forestier, mm-hmm. it's always a pejorative connotation with that. Mm-hmm. So they don't have a lot of interaction with the ministry and the capital, and when they have interaction, it's not always good from both sides, so mm-hmm. the people from the capital don't like too much the people from the forest, and the people from the forest thinks only trouble come from the capital. So there was that history that was not put in the equation of a mistrust between the forest and the main response team from the Ministry of Health or the ministry also, or the international responder. So that was something. But because of this mistrust, retrospectively, we found that people were hiding a lot of the fact. Mm-hmm. So I go a bit further, but when I left Guinea, we thought at that time that there was no case going on in Conakry anymore. Mm-hmm. And that in Guinea, if Forestier, the number was reducing a lot. So we didn't, there was a replacement team that arrived from Atlanta, from CDC, that went to Guinea Forestier and stayed there, so we never left an empty spot.
When did you go back then the first time?
I think it was around 9, 10, or maybe mid-May.
In mid-May?
Yeah, it was, I think, I stayed more or less 6 weeks.
But that's important. So in May 2014, your impression is that you've no knowledge that there are cases ongoing in Guinea.
Yeah, but think that it was not finished, but it was the trail of the outbreak, and it will finish mm-hmm. soon. And I think everybody has that feeling. I think everybody, most of the responder, mm-hmm. international, and to go in the same direction. We had at the same time in April a small flare of case in Liberia. Mm-hmm. And also that case seems to have, or the number of cases reduced, and this flare vanished. So we thought, okay, we had an introduction in Liberia, it was taken care of, and that part is over also. Mm-hmm. So we had several point that make us think that it's not finished, but it's going to finish soon, and that that's it. Obviously, we were wrong, but...
Yeah. Well, I just want to ask you specifically on that. You're being very frank about what you did know and the assessments you made. You gave an interview in the New York Times in December 2014. I just quote from it. You said it was an unprecedented outbreak. It never happened before. There were a lot of things we didn't know at the time. No one could have imagined that it would be what we have now. So my question for you is, what didn't we know at the time that we should have known?
So it seemed we don't have all the data. I'm not sure we're going to have. Is we thought, again, like Liberia was over. There was no more case. I think there was certainly a misinterpretation. There was certainly case, but they were not recalled and known. We think at the same time it could have been already some case in Sierra Leone. Nobody reported them. The population at this corner between Guinea Forestier, Sierra Leone, and Liberia are only one population, the Kisi people, and they speak the same language, whatever the country is. For them, the border doesn't exist. Is either a river that you cross every day and nobody care about it, or it's not even a river and you just walk or drive and you cross the border. So it's only, for them, it's only one country, and it's the Mano River area following this Mano River population. So for them, and I think at that time we didn't know that people were already, the three countries were already seeded. And the outbreak will start. And I think that, for me, that the only explanation for this tsunami of case that we saw in Liberia and Sierra Leone, that suddenly we had this wave of case coming from everywhere, and it was quasi impossible to track and even to do a chain of transmission. It was case everywhere. And that could have been possible only by sitting in different area before and everything being undercover and then suddenly exploding at the same time.
Another way the question might be put, you're a virologist, essentially, yeah. Specialist. So my understanding is at the beginning of this outbreak, one of the questions was essentially, has the virus changed? Is there something different the virus is doing? Is it mutating? Is it spreading more effectively in a different way? Or do other factors account for the scale of this epidemic? What is your view on that?
I don't think it's the virus. In fact, very early, the virus that was found was found to be from the Zaire species of virus, a little bit different as expected, but not that different. There was a misunderstanding, unfortunately, and that's my position, the taxonomy or the naming of the virus changed. Someone decided to change it. I don't think it's a good idea. But before, we used to have Ebola Zaire, Ebola Sudan, Ebola thing, but there was always Ebola. And then the taxonomy changed, and now the only Ebola virus is the formerly known as Ebola Zaire. The other one is called the Sudan virus or the Reston virus or the Ivory Coast virus. So when the paper was published, it was done according, the first paper coming in the New England Journal of Medicine, it was labeled according to the new taxonomy. A new species of Ebola virus was found. A new Ebola virus was found. In fact, it was understood by everybody that normal, that it's a new species and we have something really different there. Well, in fact, he was just saying that it's still what was known as Ebola Zaire, but now it's called Ebola and it's a different Ebola virus. But that.
But essentially, you're saying it was the same virus.
It's the same virus with few change. Mm-hmm. And what we learned during all this outbreak that the virus changed slowly, evolved in the different country, and now we have some three or family tree of virus that showed this evolution, but there was not a lot of change and not a lot of mutation and a lot of transmission. Now, the only difference with this virus compared to other combination virus and human of this virus compared to the previous outbreak is the fact that this virus give a lot of diarrhea. Diarrhea have always been in the clinical spectrum of patient inpatient infected by any of the Ebola virus. But in this case, you have diarrhea that looks like cholera in some time. And we know that this diarrhea could be infectious. And when you have that amount of diarrhea, it's very difficult to manage for the patient and for the family or for the healthcare worker. So that's certainly one clinical factor or one sign or symptom that could be responsible for the large amount of case. But we still have, we used to measure the R node, so one patient, how many patients are infected by one patient. We're still very low. There is not a big change in that, if when you compare that to other disease like flu, measles, or other infectious disease where you can have 20 cases coming from a single one. In Ebola, it's not the case. It's just around 2-3 maximum. So it's still limited, but certainly this diarrhea has a huge impact on the rate of transmission.
Sorry, the area, did you say?
In all this, because that huge diarrhea have been seen only during this outbreak and in the three country, because it's more or less the same virus with small difference, but in the same country. And we still don't know what the cause of this huge diarrhea. The few animal models that I've made since with this Makona virus never show that kind of diarrhea. So we don't know what the role of that.
Okay, so I take it what you're saying is that there are some clinical differences that may be significant in explaining the transmission,
yeah,
but that would only explain part of why the transmission was so great. So what factors do you think?
So the other factor is the movement of people. And we saw, for example, in Liberia, when we had the small flare, is someone sick in Lofa County, in the northwest county of Liberia, and she seek treatment in Margibi or in the other place of the country, a complete different district. And in Guinea, I used to say that the case, the contact, and the corpse are traveling. Everybody's traveling, and people have been arrested in the complete eastern prefecture of Guinea with a dead body in the car that was already dead when they left Conakry, and they traveled for 20 hours with the corpse, not in a coffin, but seated in the back seat with other people alive, traveling that way just to get buried somewhere else.
To take them back to our ancestral burial.
Yeah, presumably. So people keep moving a lot. Mm-hmm. Now, in Guinea, there is also another factor that is go maybe against that. There is still thing that we don't understand. Every time the virus and the patient left either the Guinea Forestier or the coastal Guinea, where the outbreak is still right now in Forecaria, the virus never stayed very long, and there was only 2-3 generation of patients and the outbreak stopped. And we don't explain that. So we had several flare that went to Kurimale, Telimele, Bofa, even Conakry, where you have 2-3, maximum 4 generation, and the outbreak stopped. When he went to Mali, it was the same. In Mali, there was 4 generation maximum, I think. There, and there is something different when in Guinea Forestier or in the Basque Coast, in Forecaria, in Guinea, or in Sierra Leone, or in Liberia, the virus and the the generation keep going one after the other, and it's very difficult to stop. And I don't think we have an explanation for that. There is certainly an behavior of the people. Some anthropologists should look at that. Something happening, making that the virus stop. It's true that in all this area of Guinea that I'm talking about, the majority of people are Muslim. It's true that the imam have a lot of power and are listening by everybody. So if we succeed to convince the imam that they should do some kind of behavior to stop it, he will say that at the Friday prayer and it will stop. Some people also make the point that the Muslim have washed their hand five times a day because of the prayer, and that could also have an impact on secondary transmission. There is strictly no data to prove that. Yeah, we know that they wash their hand five times a day, but there is no data that saying that it has a role in transmission. But we're trying to find reason or excuse to try to explain why it stopped there and didn't stop somewhere else.
But that's fascinating. So what you're describing is that it could be a combination of the religious structure of Guinean society, but also the way that it, because it's a more rural agricultural country, and I don't know the road networks, but
very poor,
right? So perhaps
that doesn't, people keep traveling even with very poor road.
Yeah.
The other thing is the Muslim buried corpse very quickly. They has to be done in 24 hours if you can, when some other area, especially in Guinea Forestier, the body are kept several days before being buried. Could have also an impact in the transmission, in the number of people that are involved in touching or washing the body or touching the body after the fact. So that certainly has also a role, and that will explain why he stay in Guinea Forestier.
I just want to take you out of Guinea Forestier for a moment and talk about your interactions when you come back here to Atlanta, the CDC, in this period in May. So what conversations are you having with your colleagues at the CDC and also with other infectious disease experts who might be advising the WHO and other organizations?
I think within CDC, but I'm sure other people within other organizations also, like WHO, I had certainly the impression that the outbreak was not finished, but it was just the bumping end of the normal outbreak. There were still people from CDC in the field taking care of it, and it will finish. So my talk about that was saying, well, it's another outbreak, and if we're lucky, going to stop quickly, and that's it. But I never thought it would be persisting such a long time. And again, besides some clinical signs were different, the fact that in Liberia, apparently also they had this flare and they succeed to clear it very quickly, well, everything pushing in the same direction. It's a normal outbreak.
I mean, as you know, there's been a lot of criticism of the WHO's role, their lack of action or timely action. I'm just wondering, given what you said, do you have a certain sympathy for the position they were in, trying to assess the risk of Ebola, given that there are also lots of other diseases presenting a global health risk in this period?
I think it's always nice to have someone you can blame for something, but I think everybody is to blame. Everybody has the same assessment. Some people are more or less, some organizations are more or less disorganized. So we can say WHO was disorganized. The big misunderstanding is everybody put a sign. So you have MSF, WHO, CDC. In fact, there is several MSF, there is several WHO. There is only one CDC. But there is different level in the organization to respond. It's always true, and that was a big, that remain a big problem in this outbreak, is the people with previous experience with Ebola are very limited. We don't have that many people because the outbreak have been limited, the number of people involved have been limited, so we don't have a lot, and the size of the outbreak required to have thousands of responders, and a lot of them are, or some of them are reinventing the wheel every time. And when you have to maintain a long-term presence in one place, you're forced to have some different group going one after the other, and there's always a risk of losing information in between, and that happened for everybody. So I think the British was responsible. Okay, everybody could be also responsible for not having helped this country before. They all came out of civil war, more or less. They all have political problems, so that everybody's fault and nobody's fault.
I wanted to ask you, retrospective, as I understand it, there have been some critical, if I could put it this way, pinch points identified in the epidemic. So places, so Kenema, Kai Laon and Kenema would be one in Sierra Leone. So when the virus entered, the argument is there was an opportunity, if action had been taken and resources mobilized quickly enough to stop it there before it came to Freetown. One can make a similar argument about Lofa in Liberia. Mm-hmm. Guinea, for the reasons you've just explained, is more complicated. It was already in Conakry, and it seems to have moved around the country differently. But my question essentially is, you know, do you think if enough resources had been mobilized in May, June to these areas, or was it already too late by then?
My gut feeling, it was already too late. The problem is none of this country has a surveillance system, so we don't know exactly what's going on anywhere. Obviously, before the outbreak, there was no lab doing the diagnostic. After, there was a little bit more. But I think it was very difficult. He came from Kalyaon and he went to Kenema. Well, there is not a single path to go from one to the other. People are going in also in the neighboring district in both country or district, prefecture, or province, as depending of the country, were already there, and there was no system to detect them, take care of them, block them, and doing that. So I don't think there was. And in all the country, it's a place where you have difficult road, difficult place to go, no organization to rely on, even if there were no surveillance, but there was already a public health system. You can just graft people on the system and help to take care of it. But if you have nothing, you cannot rely on anything. So it was difficult. The response could always be faster, you can always say that, but then it makes very difficult when you have different organization, different structure, different way of reporting in place. So the Ministry of Health is responsible for the country, for the health of the country, but has to be supported by other people. But then when you have several different WHO, you have CDC, then you could have some NGO, then you have the British Army helping in other things. It just make it very difficult or impossible to manage, in my view.
It's very interesting, just on this as an aside, it's very interesting the way that the international response broke down along lines of the former colonial interest, right? So the French essentially had Guinea, the British had Sierra Leone, the Americans had Liberia. You go back to West Africa at some point. Can you just take me through the next time you're in, where you're going?
So I went back in June. I don't remember exactly the date, I can't confirm that, but I went back in June in Guinea, and I stay 7 weeks, so it was June, July. The situation was different, obviously. There was much more case in Guinea Forestier. There was some case, but again, I'm not really concerned by that. Like I say, small flare going one place or the other, but that was stopped. But then at that time, Guinea Forestier was really, we saw the problem, the fact that we had really no connection between the village. It was very difficult. A lot of village were closed, didn't want us to come. There was a lot of so-called resistance. And it's resistance, obviously, that was triggered by Ebola, but it's more than that. And under the resistance, people tried to put everything, oh, it's Ebola fault, they don't want us to intervene on the mortality, the dead people, the contact. But it's the way I see it is the team responding, go in the place and then steal the dead people, put them in a body bag, remove them very quickly, and we always had trouble with burial practice because we don't follow the rule, we follow our rule. We think they are better, but they think there is better, so it's one-on-one. And then we come back, we ask questions, we follow people every day for 21 days. Well, in exchange of that, we bring strictly nothing. So these people have other trouble than Ebola. They have malaria, and we know now that, for example, the excess mortality of malaria in Guinea during the Ebola time killed more people than Ebola because people had no access to health system. So they have malaria, they have no school, they have no road, they have no water, they have no electricity. And suddenly you have people that come from everywhere to help them. But we haven't fixed anything. They still have no water, they still have no electricity, they still have no school or no teacher in the school. And we're just a pain in the neck. And Ebola came and went in some area, and they're still in the same trouble. So the resistance to Ebola or to Ebola responder is a big shield that cover a lot of things, and we haven't fixed. At one time, our thinking, I think it was the end of the first two or maybe in the second one, I was thinking we should respond differently, and we should, for example, provide each health center with a package with regular drug and treatment, some help for the village, some help for the school, maybe digging a well when they so they don't have to walk a long time to go to the river to get the water. And if you do that, you restart a health system locally that doesn't depend from the capital. One thing that even in this village, even if they have a health center, you have no drug, you have nothing. So the nurses that is in charge of that has no respect from anyone because he doesn't even know the local drug used by the traditional healers. And the traditional healer just took over because they are the one that at least are not trusted or feared by the population, but they have some tools that the nurse don't have. And I was thinking if we're doing that in different area, we can provide them, cost not a lot of money, cost certainly much less than what's spent during this outbreak, and would help at the village level. And that one thing that Guinea asks a lot is a help at the village level more than rebuilding a university hospital in the capital, which they definitely need, but that's not on the top of the list for them. And that's something that I think it's much nicer for the population.
Can I ask you, was there a difference that you noticed between the resistance to or the distrust of Western health workers and the social messaging that you encountered in Guinea as opposed to what you'd found in outbreaks in the DRC or Uganda? Or was it
No, I think it was the same. It was the same. And it's not only to Western people. It's people also from the capital or people from another tribe. In Gabon, for example, when you have Ebola in the pygmy population, they don't trust people from the capital because they know that it's trouble coming. They don't know which trouble, but they think it will be trouble. So it's exactly the same thing. It's just people coming and they will say, oh, on the pretext of Ebola, you're going to impose on us more rules, regulation, and trouble. So it's not only the Western world. It's obviously easier to spot someone from CDC or MSF or WHO coming from Geneva than someone coming from Conakry, but it's the same. It is more trouble to the outsider of the area.
Okay, I'm going to ask you to shift again, if we can. I'm not sure how long we have, but I wanted to ask about the tail end where we are now, getting to zero. We're not at zero yet. Why is it that reducing transmission to zero has proved far more difficult than anyone anticipated?
So I think it's still, it's my view, linked to the behavior of the people. So there is different, the three countries have more or less a different approach to each of them. So Liberia that finished the first, we can certainly take the credit for responding, but I was in Monrovia end of September 2014 when there was really the peak with a lot of cases everywhere. So the U.S. Army arrived and start to build some isolation or treatment center, but retrospectively, they didn't build all the one they want to build because there was no need, and most of the ones that they built were not used completely because there was less patient. I think at that time they saw a change in the population response, so they start to, I would say, abandon patient or leave dead body without an attend, without doing anything with them. And that's something that I saw in Kikwit in 95. When we arrived, there were already that fear of the sick and the dead, where we were told, oh, if you go to that village, in that house, there were sick people. Nobody goes there. We quarantine them there. And when you arrive, some of them were already dead and some were dying because nobody took care of them. And I found in the hospital in Kikwit some dead people in the hospital with some money on the top for someone and a small note, please take care of the body. We don't want to do it. And that, very bad for the patient, but that very good for the transmission because people are scared. So I think in Liberia, with the peak of the epidemic in September, October, people start to have that, or blocking the access of the village, saying, no, you don't come to our village if you're a foreigner.
Why? What accounts for what accounts for the Liberian suddenly getting this, that they got a disability?
I think it was the number of deaths. And the fact that when you walk in the street and you see dead people, you start to be scared, and then you go further. Monrovia is a big city, but I was told it's a combination of small village. That area, they all come from that village. That area, they all come from the other village. So people live in a city, but as a structure that is more repeating what they have in their own village. So that's what happened in Liberia. I don't think that happened in the other country, in the other two countries. Sierra Leone, I haven't been deployed at all in Sierra Leone. Mali was a small outbreak, so it was short. But in Sierra Leone, I was not deployed. But what we saw is we saw really that wave of case coming from Kalyaun, Kenema, Bo, and then going to the western province of Sierra Leone. The response also is different in Sierra Leone, is more military-like, is organized by the military. Mm-hmm. people, when they put in quarantine, they really lock in the house or in the compound where they live, which has also an effect of fear. People don't want to declare case because they say, okay, we're all going to be blocked in the village or in the house. Guinea, the number of cases was large in some area, but it really took some time and some understanding at each and every village to pass the message and to be able, and they doing that. The problem, if they keep traveling. So we had all the recent case that we had the ping pong between the Forikaya area and Conakry, and Conakry to the Forikaya area, and they keep moving there. So you keep going. The number of cases is very low. It's few cases every week, or you have 3 cases and no case for 10 days, and then 2 cases and no case for 10 days. And then, so you keep going, prolonging the duration of the outbreak, but the number is not very high. And apparently, we think there is no case. There is still some surveillance in some other district, and there is no case in other district. But we're not away from someone moving from one place to the other and coming and traveling in another prefecture of Guinea with case, and it's difficult to block. In addition of that, you have the election, the fact that in the Forikaya area the authority is not that different. There is a lot of things that are sold in Forikaya that are not officially sold or not allowed, so the control is very difficult.
Thank you. So last question, Pierre, and that is, how can the world avoid a repeat of this sort of catastrophe and ensure faster and better containment of Ebola next time?
So the best way to avoid it is to put in place in this country and in the other country, because if there was in Sierra Leone, there is no reason that you have not a next outbreak in Ghana or in Ivory Coast, is to put a surveillance system where you know more or less what's going on. In none of this country, we know how many people died every day. There is no record, there is no statistic on that. So it will be impossible to detect the first case. We can forget about that. Now, what we would like to detect is cluster of case. So one case will infect the next generation, and then you will have several cases, and that's what you want to detect. But in order to do that, you need to have a surveillance in place. You need to have a laboratory, not in every village, but at least in every country. You need to have a response team that will be able to go and respond and see what's going on, or investigate every time you have a cluster. Again, the problem is to remove that from the background noise, because there is a lot, again, Ebola is a rare disease, there is a lot of other reasons to die. So even if you look at the cluster of the death or unexplained death, you're still going to have very few of them that will be Ebola. Maybe you will have none of them. In other countries where we know that there was Ebola before, let's say in Gabon, the last case in Gabon was 99. The last case in Republic of Congo, Congo-Brazzaville, was 2005. And since there is no case, at least that we know of, the surveillance, at least in Republic of Congo, is more or less the same. So they people following wildlife and big apes, so they're looking at the mortality of this animal, and they haven't seen anything. So it's a very rare event, and because it's rare, it's very difficult to do that. But unless they have a system, again, of surveillance, of response and diagnostic and response, it could happen again. Okay, now we can say we have more people trained how to respond, we have all of that, but every time we have to reinvent the wheel. So I think the only response is that, and it's partly what global health security is based on. Now, it costs a lot of money, so someone's going to have to pay the bill. this country can't really pay the bill. They have the personnel, but they need the training of the people, they need the salary of the people, they need the supply, the logistics, and everything.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I think that's a good spot to end, don't you?
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. That's excellent.